Hello, you're listening to the Wellspring Podcast, dedicated to quenching your thirst for bygone days. I'm Gwen Toonman, an author digging into the past for details that will form the bedrock of my novels and short stories. Today we're visiting the topic of pioneer food gardens and orchards. What must food growing have been like for the earliest newcomers to Upper Canada? Many families arrived with a sack of seed and little else. This spring, when we cleared ground for planting vegetables, I thought about how much more difficult the task must have been for the earliest settlers. Before planting food, settlers first had to cut down an army of trees and remove obstacles like roots and boulders. I certainly didn't have to contend with such challenges. Our plot will generate produce to can or freeze, but nothing sufficient to sustain us until the next growing season. Plants are just beginning to yield, and August is half over. Settlers often wrote to their families abroad to bemoan the Upper Canada climate. How often this new land thwarted their gardening efforts with its three growing months, June, July, and August. James Rapson of Galt wrote to his family in 1832 decrying the hot weather. Not only was the summer brief, but the scorching heat withered his oats, Indian corn, and cucumber. By comparison, Upper Canada was much hotter than England. For new settlers, the differences did not end there. They found that in Upper Canada, September to November and March through April were similar to English winters, but December to February punished with its severely cold temperatures and the accompanying frost and snow. Another challenge to Upper Canada gardening was the variance in soil type. In 1835, George Coleman of Woodstock gave an account of an area where soil was light and sandy, yet half a mile away the land was rich with mold. At another nearby site, the land consisted of unworkable clay. He advised against cultivating where pines and cedars grew or where there was swampy ground. The best land, he maintained, was where the oak, walnut, beech, and maple grew. In 1833, James Goulring, a single laborer from York, grew a one-acre garden along Lake Ontario. At about the same time, the Parkers, a family of five in Adelaide Township, thought it sufficient to plant 3 acres of Indian corn along with potatoes and 4.5 acres of wheat. As was commonly done, they wrote to British relatives requesting seeds for crookhorn peas, a field pea grown for feeding livestock. Swedish turnips, also known as rutabaga, were grown to feed livestock, while a smaller white variety were grown for human consumption. Edward and Catherine Boxdale, also of Adelaide Township, wrote home to request onion seed, carrot seed, and mangel wurzel seed, a variety of beet grown for feeding cattle. By 1825, Colonel Talbot of the Talbot Settlement boasted a garden that was, according to Joseph Pickering, better stocked than most in America, yet like a good common one in England. Talbot's garden included cabbages, cucumbers, Swedish turnips, and other commonly found vegetables, plus a few hills of hops, useful for brewing ale. He also grew a number of fruits, cherries, plums, apricots, nectarines, apples, gooseberries, currants, watermelon, and muskmelon. Fruit plantings of gooseberry, raspberry, strawberry, and currants could be imported from England, but settlers commented that these fruit was seldom as flavorful as when grown in England. Asa Burnham, a resident of Cobourg, Upper Canada, was not only a judge, but a progressive settler who experimented with cultivating fruits and vegetables. He grew the small white variety of turnip during the 1830s and 1840s when turnips were considered a luxury. Despite his concern that hoeing and cultivating may harm the turnips, he turned out a successful crop. In the Niagara District, also known as the Garden of Canada, peaches and cherries have been grown since 1793. Most settlers, however, made do with collecting wild fruit such as grapes. Many people who had orchards left the fruit to drop on the ground for pigs to forage. In 1796, the forward-thinking John McIntosh of Dundas County transplanted several apple wild trees. Grafts from one of his trees were distributed to other like-minded enthusiasts. Today, McIntosh Reds are a favorite apple throughout the province. In the late 1820s, Catherine Partrell wrote this about the Upper Canada log houses and shanties she encountered. Around the habitations were orchards, bending down with a rich harvest of apples, plums, and American crab. Those beautiful little scarlet apples, so met with as wet preserve among our sweetmeats at home. As early as 1616, Samuel de Champlain wrote about the Neutrals, a First Nations group. He commented on the grain, tobacco, pumpkins, and maize grown at their villages along the northern shores of Lake Erie. Native peoples often supplied wild fruits to the Upper Canada settlers. Mrs. Simcoe, wife of the governor, enjoyed wild cranberries, strawberries, raspberries, and cherries supplied by the First Nations people. She wrote an account of Colonel Talbot bringing her a cake of dried hurtleberries made by natives. She said they tasted like Irwin's patent black currant lozenges, but tasted of smoke. Mrs. Simcoe also wrote about tending watermelon, the cultivation of which was introduced from the United States. Catherine Partrell referred to Indian corn as a useful and profitable crop, selling for $1 a bushel in 1833. First Nations women taught her to plant it by raising the earth with the edge of a broadhoe and dropping in 3 or 4 kernels. In every third or fourth hole in every row, she also planted a pumpkin seed. The large pumpkin leaves shade the young corn shoots and help the soil retain its moisture. The corn was ground for flour and mixed with water and milk to make saporn, a porridge popularized by the Americans. This podcast's corresponding blog post contains a beautiful photograph of First Nations men gathering rice in October 1921. Catherine Partrell once commented that rice beds from a distance look like low green islands. Affluent settlers hired servants to tend their food gardens in order that their own attentions could be turned toward reviving horticultural practices they'd known in England. In the late 1700s and early 1800s, high-ranking government officials developed lavish estates outside of York, known today as Toronto. Their gardeners experimented with fruit, vegetables, and flowers typical of English gardens. Although the membership of agricultural and horticulture societies consisted of more rural than urban dwellers, meetings were commonly hosted at taverns in a nearby town. Agriculture societies held exhibits in most settled areas of Upper Canada. In 1820, government legislation provided the financial means for these societies to conduct fairs and exhibitions twice yearly at York, Cobourg, and Port Hope. Crops were shown in the autumn in conjunction with horse races and plowing matches. In the circumstance of county-level agricultural societies, the hosting of the annual fair was rotated between prominent villages. Some smaller fairs were sponsored by townships or village agricultural societies. That's it for today's episode of the Wellspring Podcast. If you'd enjoy the vintage photography associated with this podcast, please visit gwentuman.com. That's GWENTUIMAN.com and search Pioneer Gardens and Orchards. While you're there, please leave a comment or a question. Share the article on your social media. You can hear more of this great music at CherylCastleman.com. The link appears on the Wellspring Podcast page on my website. Thanks for joining me. I'm so glad you're here. Stay inspired, keep smiling, and we'll chat again soon. Outside, looking.